Welcome back to the Live from the Podium series. In this episode, we hear from Dr. Samantha Nutt, founder of War Child, global humanitarian, and best-selling author, who speaks about what makes an effective leader stand above the rest and how we can all become one.
Thank you very much for that generous introduction. It's cold in here. Are you guys cold? I blame the patriarchy. I don't know about the rest of you, but anyway, hopefully we can warm things up in here. It's such a huge honor for me to address all of you this evening, and I'm a huge fan and have been for many years of Women of Influence. So it is no slight against your extraordinary achievements that this year they asked a nut to be your keynote speaker. But I do want to take a moment to thank Jan Frolic, because not only has she put on this fabulous event for all of us tonight, she is the co-chair of a fabulous initiative that War Child is involved in that will take place on November 7th. It looks, if you have little programs, if you want to pull it out, you'll see a little bit more about that. But this is, Jan is co-chairing this initiative in support of War Child with Sarah McLaughlin and Chantal Kirby-Azek, and so that'll take place here in Toronto. So thank you so much, Jan, for all of your hard work, not only on behalf of women in this country, but around the world as well. I really appreciate it. And we have another committee member here too, Sandra Pierce, so thank you for your hard work too. Now, what a powerful and extraordinary and exceptionally good-looking room this is. You are women from all professional walks of life, and you are blazing trails and empowering other women right across this country. And so to show my appreciation to all of you here today, I've brought you a little gift, a kind of swag bag of sorts. It's actually quite incredible. I guarantee it's going to change your life. It was hard for me to cram it into my suitcase because there are quite a few of you here this evening. So what am I going to give you that could possibly change your life? I am going to give you nothing less than eternal youth. Now, I discovered it. It's not transferable, by the way, so you can't go home and give it to your friends. I discovered it on one of my visits to a remote village in Africa, and if you doubt its potency, I am actually 87 years old. So do get ready for that. However, here's the deal. I'm going to save this until the very end of my presentation so that I can guarantee I have your undivided attention for the next 32 minutes, all right? Now, how's the volume? Can you hear me in the back of the room? I know it's a bit echoey, so if you can't hear me at any point in time, stand up and wave your hands. Not only will it keep you warmer, it'll also let me know that you can't hear me. Now, tonight I was asked to reflect on women's leadership and some of the lessons I have learned in my efforts to build and grow War Child over the past, almost 20 years. And what I love the most about events like these is that it gives us as women the opportunity to be open and forthright about the unique challenges that so many of us face each and every single day. Because it's not easy, is it, right? Sometimes leadership is downright frightening and soul-sucking. And no one is actually born to lead, despite all pretenses to the contrary. And I know that I certainly was not born to lead, especially with the last name Nutt. You know, this is hard for me to believe now, but there was once a time in my life, in my early teens, and this lasted right up until my early 20s, when I was afraid to leave a voicemail message. Now, what could possibly have been going through my head? Certainly uncertainties, insecurities. And to be fair, you know, I had legitimate reasons to feel insecure. When in my early teens, I had to wear dental headgear because I had two crossed front teeth. And for those of you who are not old enough to remember dental headgear, imagine taking a jock strap and putting that jock strap on your head and then wearing it to school each and every single day. I had tight, curly hair, and it used to stick out in these giant pyramid tufts, which, you know, gave me this kind of distinctly Krusty the Clown-looking appearance. I think that when I turned 13, my parents just took one look at me and went, well, I guess we can spare her the sex talk. But back to me and those voicemail messages. You know, I remember thinking, well, what if I sound dumb and then I can't go back in and erase it? Or what if my voice is too high? You know, that used to be a really big one for me because I would hear it a lot in the classroom. Every time I put my hand up in class, inevitably some boys would go, oh, there she goes again. Squeak, 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 squeak. And it's amazing how much those grade school taunts stick to you, isn't it? But, you know, those voices in our heads, those voices that lead young girls in particular to believe that they are paradoxically too much and yet never enough, you know, words like too aggressive, too mean, not nice, unattractive, too thin, too fat, too shrill, too opinionated, too obnoxious. You know, these are ugly words deployed throughout our lives and our careers that can frankly leave us feeling overcome and overwhelmed for one simple reason. And that's that they make us doubt ourselves. And it's a trap. And far too many of us never manage to climb out of it. And unfortunately, it is a major barrier to women's advancement everywhere in the world. After all, the best way to control a population, and by way of proof, I offer up every dictatorship in human history, but the best way to control a population is to render them paranoid. Which is why I want to focus my comments tonight on how we as women, how we can lead through these challenges. And some of you might be wondering right now, you might be thinking, well, this is a women's talk. Does she not see there are some men here? I do see you, gentlemen. Put up your hands. Where are you? There you are. Welcome to Women of Influence. The world needs more men just like you. Thank you for being here. But this is a woman's talk. Do stick around, though. You know, you might learn a few things or two. But I want to talk about how we can lead through some of those challenges and how we can withstand the inevitable ups and downs of our careers and the criticisms and the paternalisms and those moments of self-doubt. Because I have found that it helps to have certain tools at your disposal. You know, these are kind of a bag of tricks that I find they have certainly seen me through the most difficult professional moments of my life, and I hope that they will do the same for you. And these are the tools that I cling to each and every single time I feel shut down or shut out or simply unable to do this work, which is frankly a lot more often than you might expect. I mean, after all, I have been ostensibly working for world peace for the last quarter century. And all you have to do is turn on the news or open a newspaper or go online to understand just how far we are from achieving that goal. You know, we are facing the worst refugee and famine crisis since World War II. And violence in particular and conflict have resurged, especially in the Middle East and many parts of Africa, not to mention the rising threat of terrorism. So believe me, I know what it means to second-guess yourself and to second-guess the choices that you have made in life and to wonder whether I have the reserves left over to continue doing this work. But I tell you what, I am no longer afraid of leaving a voicemail message, and I am well past that time in my life when I can be intimidated by power, authority, a sexist tweet, because believe me, I get quite a few of those, or a room full of pimply-faced teenage boys. And with a measure of luck and some effort, future generations of women and girls won't even know what that feels like. And so I thought I would begin this conversation about women and women's leadership and why our impact is so desperately needed by taking a look at where the feminist movement has left us. Because I find it can get all, you know, a little bit confusing. Because we have been inundated lately, have we not, by an entire Magna Carta of post-feminist pop lit, telling us what we can and can't do, should or shouldn't be, lean back, lean in, lean forward, because heck, it's the end of men. Or maybe I have that wrong. Maybe it's actually that women can't have it all. Or maybe I have that wrong. Maybe it's actually about how many bebes we have. And I can never tell whether two is the new one or three is the new two. Welcome to the new feminism. I call it the sisterhood of the traveling rants. It changes with the seasons, and it is fast and cheap and flirty. But I will say one thing. In the end, this brand of feminism, this vision of women's lives, is nothing but noise. You know, forget work-life balance. It doesn't exist. If you wake up each and every single day and just deal with the things that are on fire, that is a very good day indeed. So forget that, and forget self-actualization, and forget Zen gag platitudes that are primed for your yoga bags. None of them mean anything. If you want to know what feminism ought to be in the 21st century and why your leadership matters, you need to step away from that noise and instead pay attention to the silences, to what is left too often unspoken and unaddressed. You know, consider that of the top 1% of income earners in this country, 83% of those are male, despite the fact, as you've already heard, that women are across the country entering and completing post-secondary education in larger numbers than their male counterparts. You know, and this is not a question, as has been often portrayed, of just simply keeping your hand up in the boardroom. It's not as simple as that. It is more accurately a question of access and opportunity. You know, of course, the challenges that belie all of us here this evening as women striving to lead, you know, there are even bigger disparities, ones that we can and should be paying attention to in many other corners of the world. You know, poverty, as we know, disproportionately affects women, and only 30% of girls around the world have the opportunity to attend high school. And in Africa and the Middle East, women are still struggling to wrest their dreams of equality from war and a violent misogyny in the form of ISIS and Boko Haram and other groups who would deny women and girls the right to live autonomous lives and even to go to school. And then consider that here at home, you know, First Nations women experience disastrously high levels of poverty as well as physical and sexual violence, and far too many of them are missing and murdered. Can we lead through these barriers to women's advancement? Of course we can. But we have to be prepared to challenge the complacency that so often underpins them. And to do that, I have found it's helpful to have a couple of tools at your disposal. Let's call them One Nut's Life Leadership Lessons. You don't need to write these down or anything because I'm happily send them to Jan and she can put them on the website for you guys. But the first one is this. Ignore the blowhards. Too often, as women especially, and I'm going to explain what I mean by this, but this piece of advice I'm hoping will be something that you will remember forever. You know, because too often we allow ourselves to be limited by someone else's assumptions and prescriptions when it comes to what we think we are capable of. You know, I can't tell you when I was first starting out as a young physician how many times I would hear from people who were very well-meaning, but they would often say things to me when I would express an interest in doing international work and my interest in women and violence and working in war zones. They would say things like, well, you know, Sam, this path that you are on, it's okay while you're young. But, you know, eventually you might want to have a kid and you might want to get married. Maybe have a house. And you're going to want to settle down. Well, the hell with that. You know, here I am, one child and one husband later. Okay, that just came out wrong. I am still with the husband. He's a good guy. Some of you might know him. I'm still with the husband, but I am also still hopelessly unwilling to settle. And I have no doubt that I am in a room full of some fairly uncompromising women and a couple of men. Where are you, gentlemen? You still here? Excellent. So let us all be mercilessly unapologetic about it. You know, one of the great, glorious things that happens when you turn 40, and for those of you who aren't 40 yet, you have something really, really exceptional to look forward to. The great thing that happens when you turn 40 is that suddenly permissions are something that you grant and not something that you seek. But early on in my career, I didn't fully understand this. You know, I would qualify my opinions with things like please and sorry and maybe I'm wrong, but... And then something happened to change all of that. You see, before starting War Child, I'm going to give you a bit of background here. I was, strictly speaking, what you would call a field person. You know, I'd spent time in some of the worst places on Earth working primarily for the United Nations. And the trouble was, I wasn't satisfied with how I was helping. You know, everywhere I traveled, everywhere I worked with a number of different organizations, all I saw in really difficult environments, all I saw were missed opportunities. I saw large infrastructures staffed primarily by foreigners. And when those cameras went home and the funding went along with it, that infrastructure, that capacity, packed up and moved on. And when it did exist, it was often dangerously disconnected to the local population that it was supposed to be serving. In addition to all of that, these were programs that overwhelmingly focused on people's short-term needs. Food, water, shelter, blankets, vaccination programs, all incredibly important, but that rarely ever tackled or even attempted to address some of those structural deficits, those big challenges that underpinned that violence and conflict in the first places. Question of women's rights, economic development, education, ending impunity, for example. And so bridging that gap, building an organization that would work in complex environments, but to disrupt that cycle of poverty and violence and war, that became the genesis of War Child Canada. And in that period of time, the organization has grown from a volunteer staff of one, and you're looking at her, with a cell phone and a backpack, because nothing quite breeds confidence like a young woman with a backpack. This is very common, by the way, in the NGO sector. Those of you in the corporate sector are probably horrified, but most of us actually still carry backpacks when we are given the opportunity. But that organization has grown from that cell phone and that backpack with a budget of good intentions, thanks to the help of many exceptional people, some of whom are here today, into an internationally acclaimed humanitarian organization that has worked in dozens of war-torn regions over the years, that has raised more than $80 million for the cause of war-affected children, and that helps 500,000 children and their families each and every single year. Thank you. But you know what? It almost didn't happen. And this is when I'm going to get back to the importance of ignoring the blowhards here. It almost didn't happen because the entire process was so relentlessly discouraging. In those early years of War Child, I spent probably the first 2 years going around, knocking on doors, asking people to get behind our efforts, and everyone universally said no. And we had pulled together a board, a great board. They were very, very, very helpful, very encouraging, but even they were exasperated. They were completely frustrated, had never seen something that would be so hard to get off the ground. And so at a certain point, the chair of our board, our founding chair, great man by the name of Frank O'Day, he's also one of the founders of Second Cup Coffee. And so he turned to me and he said, look, Sam, I think our fundamental problem is, you're a doctor and you're a field person and you go out there and you're telling people all this stuff in full paragraphs and people want easy. And so we've got to figure out how we're going to put this message out there and we should have some kind of a campaign. And then he said to me, after much effort and persuasion on his part, he said, look, I've arranged for you to pitch the head of a major public relations firm here in Toronto, actually. And so he said, if they get behind us, maybe, that we can make this thing go. But if not, I don't know how we can help you. We may have to call it. So I prepared for weeks for this meeting, what I thought was my last shot. And I go in, and I walk into the boardroom, this long table full of middle-aged white guys in suits. Not that there's anything wrong with middle-aged white guys in suits, but when you have the backpack, you kind of get the picture. And I go in there, and I sit down, and I start talking about what I had learned from my many years going in and out of war zones, places that included Somalia during the famine, which I had gone to right out of medical school, Liberia, Burundi during the genocide, Iraq. And I thought I was doing a great job. And I had a fancy PowerPoint presentation. And about midway through our conversation, the CEO interrupts me. And he says, okay, Sam, I think I've heard enough. And then he said, look, I'm going to tell you something that you're not going to like. But in the end, you're going to thank me. Because I'm going to save you a lot of time and a lot of aggravation. And with that, he said, people like local. And the cause of war-affected children just isn't marketable. So I thanked them for the meeting, packed up my stuff in my blue backpack, got on the streetcar, and I was on the verge of tears and ready to throw in the towel when I realized something. I had an epiphany. I realized something incredibly important, something that has served me well in similar situations ever since, and something that I hope will serve you well too. And what I realized was this: that guy was an asshole. And you know what? There are a lot of assholes out there. Maybe you work with one or two of them. Maybe you are one or two of them. I have no idea. There's certainly one sitting in the White House at this moment in time. The point here, and this is something I hope you won't forget, the point here is that just because someone writes or speaks with authority, it does not mean that he or she actually is one. All of us as women, we need in our own lives to seek out those champions and mentors at every age and stage of our careers in order to thrive and to succeed. Those people who see opportunities and not obstacles. Otherwise, it is far too easy to allow people like that to derail our efforts and weaken our resolve. Of course, a firm reality check is sometimes welcome, but don't give up at the first or the 50th or the 500th. I've even lost count of how many times I've been told no. Because eventually, those yeses do come. Apparently, in my case, accompanied by a sense of well-earned self-righteous indignation. But this brings me to my second takeaway message for you on women's leadership, which is really a lesson in finding meaning and purpose in your work and from your success, no matter what professional path you are on. And so my second tool is this, and it sounds pretty simple, but it's actually hard to really think about this and to finalize kind of where you sit on this. But it's really important for all of us to write our own whys. You know, we are all motivated, we're driven to work and succeed by a variety of factors. Some of them are personal, maybe they're financial, they can be creative, intellectual, or even emotional. And to be honest, it doesn't really matter. The important thing is that you find meaning and purpose in your work. And if not your work, then certainly your philanthropy. What causes are you passionate about? What contributions are you most proud of? It's important to identify these, because in those hard moments, those moments whether you have the courage or the strength to keep going, to lead through the tough times, it does help to lean on those instances of quiet satisfaction. They serve as a constant reminder that no one ever changed anything by giving up and walking away. So let me give you another example from my own work, because there certainly have been times, many, many times, when I have wondered whether it's too hard, when I have thought that maybe the risks, the heartbreaks, the threats to my own life on a few occasions, and there have been a couple of those, I have come under heavy gunfire, I have grieved the loss of far too many of my friends to war, and I have wept the world over with women who have been raped, tortured, abused, and whose children have been murdered in front of them. And I won't deny that in the face of that, sometimes I too have very serious doubts whether I have the resolve and the emotional reserve to continue doing this work. And then I think of women like Shaima. You know, she is a woman who is among the 70% of the world's poor who was denied the opportunity to ever go to school. And Shaima and I are the same age. Our main differences being that I have one child and she has seven. And she lives in Afghanistan. Her life has been framed by more than three decades of war and, as a woman, sometimes brutal oppression. You know, not too long ago, Shaima was illiterate, and her children were unable to attend school. And her husband worked a series of sporadic menial jobs. Now, Shaima's not a woman with the kind of education or even social connections who would normally access things like business development programs or finance, microfinance programs. Because, you see, women like Shaima, in a place like Afghanistan, they have extremely long odds in a country with even longer odds. And so you see, Shaima never made anyone's microfinancing list or even education list. Why not? Well, unfortunately, her intractable poverty, her lack of marketable skills, her lack of capital, I mean, in places like Afghanistan and other countries where microfinance initiatives are offered, you're generally speaking have to have a certain level of capital available to you to even be eligible for those kinds of programs. They sort of see it as a down payment on a mortgage. And then you compound that with her inability to do even the simplest mathematical equations. You know, all of these challenges made Shaima a very bad bet for any international aid agency driven by donor demands for low cost, high yield results. Because you see, that's unfortunately what those of us on this side of the world tend to prioritize. We want a one-time investment that's going to change everything. But in Shaima's world, that change takes time. Sometimes it takes generations. And it takes a great deal of patience. And so you see, the obstacles that she faced couldn't be resolved with a $10 school kit or a $40 goat or even a $300 loan. You know, I'm always astonished. Let's go back to the goat for just one second here. I'm always astonished that we would believe that something like that could actually solve a family's problems. When even here at home, we wouldn't consider sending a goat, for example, up to our northern communities for people who are facing the challenges of poverty or violence, for example. So why do we think it's okay in other corners of the world? But after a door-to-door campaign led by War Child's local partner agency, a fantastic women's organization called the Afghan Women's Council, that campaign set out to identify women like Shaima, the most impoverished, the most vulnerable, and the highest risk women and children. And by doing that, Shaima ended up on our list. She calls it making the survey. And I tell you what, she is as proud of this accomplishment as any of you here this evening. For a year, along with more than 150 other women, with War Child's support, Shaima and her school-aged children were enrolled in a combination program that provided literacy and numeracy and skills training and business development tied to market needs for women, while their children were enrolled in preschool and school-aged accelerated learning programs. And the men in the families are also involved because it's really important that they are included and consulted. Otherwise, and this happens in places like Afghanistan, far too many things like economic development programs that are administered in haste, those women go home to higher levels of violence within the home, unfortunately, and they have put women in danger. So after a year of this comprehensive training, Shaima received a loan for her new business, a tailoring business, and the first person she hired was her husband, and she taught him how to use a sewing machine. And then she enrolled her children in school, and she, along with her children, are now fully literate. And with the money that she raised in that first year, she bought more sewing machines, and she hired more women, women just like herself. And so within 2 years of making that survey, Shaima had 50 employees and is an influential woman in her community. And her father-in-law, who's a very traditional conservative elder who was once vehemently opposed to women working outside the home, he too has become an advocate for women's advancement, conceding, and this is what he said to me, that it is the best thing that ever happened to his family. But you see, Shaima put it differently. For Shaima, the difference between her old life and her new one, as she explained to me when I was visiting Afghanistan, that difference for her is very, very simple. Before, she said to me, and her voice was kind of rising above these galloping machines, she said, before, in our family, my husband was president. But now, I am president. Women and young girls in every corner of the world deserve to be presidents. Whenever I wonder whether I have made the right professional choices, or when I find myself shut out, as I frequently do, for reasons of personality or politics or economics, which can leave me overcome with frustration, I reflect on these stories, stories like Shaima's, and the countless other young women and girls that I have met around the world who each and every single day are my why. And these women seek justice, not pity, and they seek opportunity, not handouts. And above all, they ask that we find common cause with their courage, their resilience, and their naked will to endure against the forces of brutality and oppression. Which brings me to my very last takeaway message for you this evening, and I'm wrapping up in about 6 minutes. And it's one which I believe is vitally important for all of us as women leaders, particularly when it comes to advancing and mentoring women in the workplace and ensuring that we achieve gender equality at all levels of leadership. And so my last takeaway for you, and as you will recall, the first one was ignoring the blowhards. The second one was writing your why. And the last one is this. Feminism is a process. It is not a history lesson. In the early 60s, my Scottish grandmother, she was the editor of a Toronto area daily, and she was the kind of feisty old Scot, you know, the kind of feisty old Scot that was not only predisposed to ruling her own roost, but any that fell within 8 square city blocks. Some of you may know women like that. This is a difficult acknowledgement, but my grandmother betrayed her daughter's, my mother's dreams. You know, my mother was a diligent and capable student who would be the first one from our family to ever graduate from high school. And shortly before her graduation, my mom had these big plans to go on to college or to university. Shortly before that graduation, my grandmother instructed my mother to shelve those plans. And she told her that if she was going anywhere, she would be going to secretarial college instead. And she did this because, you see, as my grandmother explained to my mother, out of the four children, three girls and one boy, the only money that they had for post-secondary education would be reserved for that only boy. And he was, as it turns out, what teachers euphemistically call not academically inclined. And so when he was 16, he used that money as a down payment on a car instead. And so my mother's younger sisters, when their turn came, they didn't even see any point in asking because they knew that nothing would come of it. And so, like millions of women of my generation, I am, however bittersweet this often feels to me, I'm the beneficiary of that injustice. Resolute that her two daughters, myself and my younger sister, her name is Pippa, she got it way worse than I did because that officially makes her a peanut. Wasn't easy growing up in the nut house, folks. But resolute that her two daughters would have genuine choices. My mother assiduously rejected any and all gender conventions that might have undermined our potential, whether that was real or frankly imagined. And you know, from this domestic pulpit, my mother preached, and believe me, she still does, intellect over attractiveness, opinion over deference, and autonomy over feminine sacrifice. And on this last point, what I mean to say is that my mother found the so-called, the sort of prevailing Jackie Kennedy-styled attitudes of her generation, where good women put their partners' ambitions ahead of their own. You know, my mother found that to be complete and utter nonsense, thankfully. You know, my grandmother, like most Scots, she was anchored to her pragmatism. For her, you know, she was a survivor of two world wars. And so dreams were the playground of the idle. My mother disagreed. And I am so grateful that she did. But I also know that I should not stop there. My work with women around the world, the work that has left me elated and heartbroken, passionate and conflicted, inspired and frustrated, the best and worst of life's paradoxes. All of these have taught me that the women's movement is unfinished everywhere. Our rights are not guaranteed, inequalities are still deeply entrenched, and in some corners of the world, these are widening. This is why your leadership matters, our leadership matters, at all levels, corporate, political, bureaucratic, nonprofit, scientific, artistic, entrepreneurial, financial. This is why that leadership is so very necessary. And though the road ahead may at times be difficult, I don't believe it will prove impossible either. And so to that end, I want to wish you all the greatest success. Now, I promised you a little something, didn't I? Are you ready? You want it? The cure for aging? Eternal youth? All right, listen up. Here we go. You have to get this right. You ready? Always have a close group of friends who are at least a decade or more older than you are. Because at every birthday, they will express genuine shock and dismay at how young you still happen to be. And always have an equal number of friends who are at least a decade or so younger than you are, because it is very important that you return the favor. And if you live to be 120, and you rapidly discover that you are running out of friends in both categories, don't fret, because you will have lived a rich life indeed. If only we could all be so lucky. Thank you very much.
Can we stand up? Like, that was awesome. That was fantastic. Wow. So I'm listening to you, and I know what you've done, and I know where you've traveled, and I think about my world and even what happened today, and it feels like every day someone is saying, we live in such a crazy world. It's never been this crazy before. What keeps you up at night?
Oh, that's an excellent question. Lots of things, actually, keep me up at night. It's interesting. The things that frustrate me are not the things that you might imagine. I actually see in many of the corners in which we are working where there can be huge setbacks. One of our biggest programs is in South Sudan, which a couple of years ago, really, the security situation really deteriorated. The war resurged, and hundreds of thousands of people have been displaced. And we're on the front lines and trying to navigate that, and many of our own staff were displaced and have come under attack. And that stuff certainly does keep me up at night, but I still see the progress that we're making, and I see their resolve to keep going, and I find that personally very inspiring. What keeps me up in that equation, though, is not the nature of the work. It's seeing the progress that's being made, seeing the dedication of the staff on the ground, everything that they're enduring and living with, and then confronting the level of sort of cynicism or disengagement that we have here at home, where people will say, which I still hear all the time, things like, well, you know, I give to local charities, I don't really give to international charities. I mean, less than 10% of donations in this country go to support international humanitarian causes. And so it's the gains that are often erased because of that lack of sustained financial support and initiative from this side of the world. So that keeps me up at night. I mean, things like when our aid budget is in decline, but our military spending has just won the lottery. I mean, to me, it makes me think that the balance is off. You know, we are investing disproportionately in the machinery of our own destruction. And not investing in the other side of that equation, which is really about peace and hope and prosperity. And it sounds naive and cliched, but that's why we all get up every single day. And that doesn't change whether you live in Toronto or whether you live on Chicken Street in Kabul, Afghanistan. There is such a place. We all have to have reasons to strive and to survive. And if we don't have those opportunities, we become increasingly desperate, and we are driven to make desperate choices. And unfortunately, those desperate choices that War Child confronts around the world every day, and knowing that you can do something about that but may not have the means or the resources to achieve it, that's the stuff that makes me mad at night.
I'm sure people have questions, and while we wait for the microphone to arrive at you, and just put your hand up if you have one. For Samantha, I have to ask you, do you have a favorite country? You've mentioned Afghanistan a couple times. Is there one place that really sits in your heart?
You know, places sit in my heart for different reasons. Unfortunately, some of them, I've lost quite a few of my friends in different countries around the world, that particularly in Iraq. So it's always with a heavy heart that I go to Iraq. Even now, I've been twice in the last 6 months. So favorite is the wrong word. There are, in every country in which we're working, because I've been to most of those locations more than once, there's a certain element of feeling as if you're home. You know, I feel home here, and I feel home at home there. And it's so incredible to see amazing, 98% of our staff are local. We have 250 staff around the world, full and part-time jobs, and they are all from war zones, and they're giving back to their communities. And that is just so incredibly inspiring. So for me, you know, I like a number of them for different reasons. I'm always grateful if I'm not hearing gunfire at night, but it would be hard to pick just one. They're all beautiful and complicated and heartbreaking and inspiring at the same time.
There's a mic coming.
Thanks. I have a question. You talked about being unapologetic, and I'd love to probe on this a little bit more, just how you overcame it, you know, young in your career. I'm relatively young in my career, and I deal with, you know, more seasoned, both male and female, you know, at work, and I'd love to know some tips and tricks as to how you became more unapologetic and used it to propel you further.
Well, generously, Barbara Harmer, who works in our office, just handed me a glass of wine, which usually does make me quite unapologetic. Look, you know, there are times when we need to apologize, right? There are times when you have to recognize that you've hurt someone or you've misled someone or perhaps you weren't as honest and forthright about a situation as you should have been. You know, so I do still apologize profusely pretty much every single day. But at the same time, I think that what I have learned is not to undermine myself by assuming that someone else is a greater authority or has more right to their opinions and their ideas than I do. And so I don't self-censor that way anymore, and I don't automatically sort of internally criticize myself before I put it out there. I might criticize myself afterwards, especially if I do the national and say something stupid, which can happen. But you have to... I think it's a lot about learning to let things go, you know, and understanding that it won't be as big a deal in the morning or next week or next month. It can seem huge in that moment. But just take the time to sort of pause and look at the whole trajectory of your life. And do you really think this issue is going to really be bugging you 30 years from now? And if the answer is no, then just take it with a measure of restraint, and have faith in yourself, you know, because it's kind of the whole fake it till you make it thing. But if you act as somebody who is confident and competent and great at what you do, people will believe that you are confident and competent and great at what you do. Any other questions? Don't be shy.
Come on, because you know what's going to happen. This is going to stop, and then you're going to get mobbed when you go back there. So,
there are no stupid questions. There are only stupid answers.
I have a question for you.
Yep.
So, you mentioned a time where you were in a boardroom full of men, and you were incredibly intimidated. I'd be curious to know if there's a recent time where you found yourself being fairly intimidated in an environment like that, and how you handled it.
I think one of the great advantages to working in war zones is that it takes a whole hell of a lot to intimidate me these days. You know, if somebody's not shooting at me or standing there with mirrored glasses and fatigues and seizing my passport, then I pretty much shrug a lot of things off. But I would say that there are times when I feel, you know, where you just feel that perhaps you're not as good as you want to be, right? I know even for me, I'm sure you can relate to this, but when I do TV, I'm still incredibly nervous. I've been doing a regular thing for the National and for CTV Power Play for quite some time, and still every time I go up there, I'm nervous. And still every time I say to myself, I hope I don't say something stupid. I hope I know the answer to the question. And usually I do know the answer to the question, and usually I don't say something stupid, but I still have those moments where I'm just not good enough at this. And it doesn't matter how many times you do it. It doesn't matter how much media training you have. It doesn't matter whether you've been doing it for 10 years. You still have those moments. So I think ultimately what for me has helped is the more you do it and the more that you see that you don't screw up and you're not a spectacular failure and you're not a national embarrassment, the more confidence you have the next time. Or at least you can sort of suppress those voices that tell you that you suck and you're not going to make it. You instead say, well, actually, looking at the evidence of the last 10 years, most of the time I go out there and it's okay, actually. And I kind of hold on to that. But it happens to everyone, right? I'm really intimidated by exceptional talent. So, for example, a couple months ago, we were invited to a dinner with Peggy Atwood, who has always been one of my massive heroes in life. You know, it's she's amazing. And all I did was follow her around with a food tray the whole evening, right? Peggy, would you like more carrots? Right? If I could have taken notes, I would have. I'm sure she went home and said to her husband that I was the weirdest person she's ever met. And I probably was. So for me, people who have great skill and great gift, whether you're an exceptional interviewer or an exceptional writer, or, you know, fantastic in the theater, or you just really know your finance, like people who are smart and brassy and funny, I love those people. I have a number of whys that all fall into the same category. This evening I told you one story, but there are a few others. There are a few others of young girls and women that I have met over the years who have taught me things, who were brave, frankly, in ways that I could never be. Some of them are not alive anymore to champion this cause, to champion the issues. Two of my really good friends were murdered in Iraq. One was Akila al-Hashmi, who was appointed to the Interim Iraqi Governing Council in 2004. And she was gunned down a few days later in front of her home. And the other one was a woman by the name of Margaret Hassan, who was the head of CARES operations out of Baghdad. And she was abducted on her way to work. She's a dual Iraqi British citizen, and abducted on her way to work. And then she was held hostage by what became ISIS, but initially back then it was the early sort of form of Zarqawi's network. And she was sold up the chain and forced to record these videotaped messages targeting the UK, telling them to withdraw their troops. And then they eventually executed her. And she was one of my earliest mentors in this field. I'd known her since the 1990s. And as hard as those stories are, they are part of why I get up and do what I do every single day. Because when I have those moments where I think, oh, this is too hard, or I'm full of self-pity, or don't want to face it anymore, I remember what an extraordinary privilege it is to be a Canadian, to have the luxury of living here, to have the opportunity to decide when I can do the work or when it's too much to make for me. A lot of the people that we work with can't make those kinds of choices because they don't have the kind of passport that would allow them to leave that violence. And it's pretty sobering, and it puts everything into perspective. And all of them are my why. And I think about them all in different ways almost every single day. And I think you kind of have to, because I don't think otherwise you would stare down this work and feel that you could move the dial forward if you didn't.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Absolutely.
Thanks, everyone.